to the Infrastructure Show. I'm your host, Professor Joseph Schoffer of Northwestern University. The Infrastructure Show is designed to present to listeners the reality of America's infrastructure, its condition, why it is the way it is, and what can be done about it. We gratefully acknowledge contributions to sustain the Infrastructure Show from Andrea and Ron DeFeo, Dr. Robert Peskin, and Dr. Raymond Ellis. Elevators are in almost every building more than a few stories tall, and we usually take them for granted except when they're absent or they're not functioning. But the technology of elevators is closely connected to the design and development of tall buildings. With us to talk about elevators and the design of buildings is Thomas Leslie, who is Morrow Pickard Chilton Professor of Architecture at Iowa State University. He works on the integration of building sciences and arts, and his 2013 book, Chicago Skyscrapers, 1871 to 1934, is an important historical source on the effects of technologies and materials on building design. Tom, I'm really happy to talk with you this morning.
Oh, great to be with you.
So can you tell us something about the evolution of elevators? I suppose this could be a book-length topic, but give us a quick overview of where they started and maybe who should get the credit for them.
Sure. Well, they actually go way back. There's evidence of fairly crude lifting devices, even in ancient building. The hoists were used mostly for freight, not for passengers, and people used stairs mostly because hoists were typically dangerous. The passenger elevator was used in English mills occasionally in the 18th century, but again, accidents and injuries meant that it wasn't widely used, and elevators were widely regarded as pretty suspect. The real invention that makes elevators a kind of useful piece of building technology for passengers comes in the 1850s, when Otis invents not a new elevator system, but a safety device that means suddenly that elevators are prevented from falling through their shafts and crushing or killing people. And it takes a while, but eventually that catches on, and the impression of elevators as a safe way to move up and down buildings really takes hold by the 1860s and 1870s. So even though hoists have been around for 1,000 years or more in buildings, the passenger elevator is really a safety invention that comes about more or less in the 1850s.
So I presume that the safety issue was that people really didn't much like the idea of falling?
The issue was that people didn't like the idea of falling through an open shaft. And you can imagine if you have a fairly simple elevator, just a box with a pulley and a rope, if the rope breaks, then the box falls to the bottom of the shaft. And it actually requires a fairly sophisticated mechanism for the elevator to know that it's falling and to do something to stop it from doing so.
And that was a safety innovation?
That was a safety innovation. It was a set of claws almost that if the rope was cut and the elevator started falling quickly, they were spring-loaded and they would catch onto the rails and stop the elevator cab violently, but nevertheless preventing the cab from falling all the way through the shaft.
So is the kind of rope and pulley system the primary mechanism for elevator functioning?
Today, it's a more sophisticated version of the rope and pulley system is one of two major systems that are used for elevators. Today, there'll be a set of what are called sheaves, pulleys that have cables going over them multiple times to get enough friction to lift a cab. And those are usually located at the top of an elevator shaft, although sometimes at the bottom. And they use gears and a system of counterweights that balances the cab so that a relatively small motor can still lift a fairly heavy cab. By far the more common system, though, for smaller installations, up to maybe 4 or 5 stories, is a hydraulic system, which uses a plunger underneath the cab to actually push the cab up and down the hoistway from below. And that uses oil, usually, in a hydraulic piston to get the necessary force to lift the cab up and down.
Is it my imagination, or does there need to be a shaft as deep as the elevator is tall?
There needs to be a shaft. The piston can telescope a couple of times, so the pit doesn't necessarily need to be totally as tall as the shaft, but there usually does need to be a fair amount of digging, and in fact, the vertical hydraulic piston only happens when there are fairly sophisticated well drilling technologies in the late 19th century to take care of that.
So now take us back to buildings. What's the connection between elevator capability and functionality and the design of buildings?
Well, there are really two factors that relate elevator design and layout to building design. One is performance. The human psychology is such that we expect elevators to show up almost right away when we push a button. And to get the number of cabs to reach that level of service, you need a whole lot of hoistways. So the hoistways take up a great deal of space, and of course they multiply as you get down further in a tall building. So if you look at the first floors of some of these super tall skyscrapers, it seems sometimes like they're almost all elevators because that's what it takes to adequately service all of the floors above. And then when you get into the office floors typically, or apartment floors with the rental floors, there's always this push and pull between where the elevators are located, how much space they take up, and how the rental space of a building can get deployed around them. And there's always this kind of push and pull about where the elevators are taking up space. Are they taking up valuable space? And can you still come up with a formula that will give you enough lettable area and have the kind of provision of elevator service that people have come to expect?
So it becomes a trade-off between how much money can somebody make on the renting or selling the building and the quality of service that the residents or the occupants experience when they need to go up and down in the elevators.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And it's a very, very delicate balance.
So who plays in this competition? Is it the architects against the engineers or against the elevator designers? How does this work out?
Well, everybody's involved in one way or another. The architects, and usually in a high-rise building, an elevator specialist will figure out the layout and will figure out how many cabs are needed, what sizes are needed, and how they lay out, usually in a building core in the area in the center of the tower. But all of the engineering team gets involved, of course, because the elevators put tremendous dynamic loads onto a building structure. So the structural engineers, of course, are concerned about that. Mechanical engineers, of course, need to work around the equipment and the shafts and things that take up a huge amount of space in the center of the building. And these days, environmental consultants are also involved because energy use is a major concern in tall building construction. And so figuring out ways to make elevators that perform effectively but also efficiently, that don't use too much energy, becomes important as well. So it ends up being a team effort, and of course everyone is usually gently fighting for their own turf. The solution to elevatoring building, as it's called, is often one that balances a number of different fields.
So I want to talk about energy, but before we get there, what you've described from my perspective is the fight for floor plan space between elevators and rentable space. But what's the connection between elevator technology and capability and the height of the building?
Well, this is one of the major discussions right now, is if you build structures that are over a kilometer tall, and there are several projects on the boards in the Middle East and Southeast Asia that are attempting to reach 1,000 meters, you run into problems just of the massive number of elevators that it takes to service that number of floors. And one thing that results from it is that you find that you can't really build a 1,000-meter tall office building because the demand on the elevators is such that you do end up with a building that's almost all elevators at the base. Most of these really super tall buildings put something like a hotel or apartments on top, and those programs place less of a demand on the number of elevators that you need.
So you're actually thinking about it from the point of view of what's the travel demand for elevators? That is, how many people want to go up and down in the elevators at a given point in time?
Absolutely right. I mean, if you think about it, if it takes a minute and a half or 2 minutes for an elevator to get from the bottom to the top of a super tall building, you're taking that shaft out of commission for a total of at least 4 or 5 minutes, more if it makes a handful of stops. So if you think that the average wait time for an elevator really wants to be less than 30 seconds, suddenly you realize that for a building with a population of thousands of people, all of whom maybe are wanting to go to lunch at the same time if it's an office building, you can do the math and realize that very, very quickly you need an awful lot of elevator shafts to handle that population and to give people the comfort of having an elevator show up very quickly after the button's pushed.
I had the opportunity a couple of weeks ago to talk to one of the design engineers for Kingdom Tower, which is, I guess, the next tallest building in the world on the order of 3,000 feet. And he said, well, what they're doing is stacking 3 elevator cabs on top of each other in one shaft. Is that a kind of a common way to respond to this demand?
Yeah, that's a way to use the floor space of the shaft more efficiently. And it's an idea that's been around for quite a while. There are actually a couple of experiments in the 1910s and 1920s that never really caught on. And there are, of course, kind of immense logistical problems of getting machinery stacked for the various cabs and the shafts on top of one another. And there are inevitably safety concerns, right? What happens if an elevator has a problem up in the top shaft? Does that affect the elevator in the lower shaft? But it does seem like those problems have been addressed, and getting people to the right floor to get on the right local elevator, if you want to think about it that way, like an express elevator that takes you to these kind of sky lobbies and then stacked local elevators that take you to the individual floor, those problems seem to have been addressed. And logistically, this is almost the only way to get that number of cabs into a building that's 3,000 feet tall.
And you also said something that strikes me as being very important, and that is to define the functionality of the building as you go from bottom to top into different zones. So this is the hotel zone, and this is a residence zone, and so forth.
Yeah, that's right. Because if you think about an office building, first of all, it can be very densely populated. You know, one person every 10 square meters or so is pretty standard. And offices are generally on a schedule. People show up to work between 7:30 and 9 o'clock. They go to lunch right about noon, and they leave between 5 and 7 o'clock in the evening. And so all of the residents of that office building are either trying to get on or get off of an elevator within a fairly short period of time. So one of the essential problems is that you have to design the elevator system for those peak loads. And of course, most of the elevators then sit pretty idle the rest of the day. If you show up at a major downtown office building at 10 or 11 o'clock in the morning, you'll find that most of the elevators are sitting in the lobby waiting to be used. It's only those kind of peak hours that require the full design of the elevator system.
I'd like to take you back for a moment to your book on Chicago skyscrapers. When you looked at that history from 1871 to 1934, could you identify some changes in building design, particularly building height, as elevators became more popular, more convenient, more common?
Oh, absolutely. And funnily enough, the elevator doesn't really seem to affect building height early on. The passenger elevator had been around for 15 or 20 years by the time Chicago started building tall, over 5 or 6 stories that were willing to walk upstairs. The really interesting developments to me came in the 1920s when Chicago started building beyond its historic 260-foot limit. And up to that point, elevatoring is pretty simple. You have a number of shafts, and they all go to every floor, and it's pretty easy to get the right number for the amount of floor area that you have. But once you start to get up to 35 or 40 stories, then efficiency becomes a real concern. And you start to see the first electric control of elevators kind of creeping in. Before 1920, almost all elevators were run by a human operator, someone who actually pushed the buttons for you and saw where the calls were coming and kind of drove the elevator to whichever floor was needed. But beginning with buildings in the 1920s, you have to have a more sophisticated system. And so the first systems of electric relays and things like automatic button controls and things like that start to come in. And that shortens the amount of time that it takes for an elevator to complete its run. It makes more efficient stops, and it makes more efficient trips. And this is really one of the ways that building height over 20 stories or so becomes kind of easy to do in the 1920s especially.
So it became less of a constraint.
Exactly. Less wait times and easier to reach floors in the upper reaches of the buildings.
Earlier you mentioned the issue of energy and energy consumption. So what are the kinds of things that one can do in design of elevators and elevator technology to save energy?
Well, one of the most interesting things right now, elevators, particularly what are called traction elevators that work with sheaves and cables, they work basically by being very finely balanced. The cab weight is offset by a counterweight at the other end of the cable that is usually tuned to be the cab weight plus about 40% of the load they anticipate. But there's always a little bit of a difference. One side is always a little bit heavier than the other. And one of the most interesting things right now is systems that put regeneration engines on the motors themselves, so that if one side is heavier than the other and it gets lifted up 15 or 20 stories, then when it is reversed and it actually drops down, that offset will actually drive a generator that will produce a little bit of electricity. And that then offsets the energy cost of lifting the heavier side the next time.
So how is that energy typically stored?
Well, it's stored in batteries, or it's used right away if there's an instant demand. It's not a huge amount, but over time, and particularly during the busier hours of the day, it adds up.
Some companies, as I understand it, are working on cableless elevators that can move both horizontally and vertically. What can you tell us about that technology? Is it in place? Is it on the way? How does it work?
Well, that's always been the kind of elevator of the future. And that's been the kind of dream for a few generations now. If you go back and look in technical publications back in the 20s and 30s, they talk about elevators that can move horizontally and that shift shafts. And the idea is that you could then use vertical shafts multiple times. And particularly today, with digital controls, you could find the most efficient pattern. How you move the cabs through the building suddenly isn't just up and down, but it's also kind of side to side. It's never really come to fruition, and it seems like the logistics and the mechanics of actually trying to go from a vertical to a horizontal movement just don't seem to pay off yet. It's too difficult, too expensive for fairly small benefit. The self-driving cabs do exist, and they're used right now mostly in retrofits in historic buildings where there isn't room necessarily to put a large motor room or a plunger. And so they actually have the drive machinery on the cab itself. And basically, it's like a cog railway. It drives up and down the shaft on its own. Those are relatively slow. So they're really only good for buildings that are a couple stories tall. The kind of dream of having a self-driving elevator cab that can still go 1,000 feet per minute is still, I think, pretty far off.
So if we look ahead, what is coming? What can we expect to see breakthroughs on these cableless concepts or concepts that move vertically and horizontally? Or is it just a better and more efficient ways to manage what we've done for a long time?
I think that for the immediate future, the improvements are likely to be pretty incremental, and you're likely to see much more sophisticated systems of servicing with digital controls and elevators that learn the use patterns in the building, kind of machine learning or artificial intelligence that learns not only from people programming it, but also watches patterns during the day and is able to anticipate when there will be a big demand in the lobby versus when there will be a big demand further up in the building. I think the actual mechanics of the elevator, they really haven't changed all that much in the last 30 or 40 years. We still rely on most of the same basic principles. And there aren't a whole lot of ways to move a box of fragile human beings up and down a really tall building. I don't think we're likely to see anything really revolutionary. I think what we're likely to see is greater and greater efficiency and probably smarter and smarter systems.
Yeah, so it sounds like big data and artificial intelligence are going to be the next step for us in the elevator business.
As in almost everything else, it seems. Yeah, I think there are real applications for elevators for big data, absolutely.
Very interesting field, and interesting, again, to look at a piece of infrastructure that maybe we don't think very much about, but we're very dependent on. Tom Leslie, thanks a lot for talking with us today. I really enjoyed it, and we'll make sure that people are aware of your book on Chicago skyscrapers. Thank you, Tom.
Great. It's been a pleasure. Thanks.